open my eyes. This is a conversation with Katerina Andreou, founder of the company HR Innovate, people-centric innovator and psychologist.
Hello, good
morning. Welcome, Katerina.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. I have been studying a little bit about your background. And I'm quite interested about the diverse exposure that you have in a number of cultures.
Yeah.
I see, for example, that you were born in Africa, raised in the Middle East.
Yes.
And educated in the UK.
Yes.
Which makes up a unique amalgam of cultural background and, I suppose, experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think those early years, especially the sort of globe-trotting, different schools, different cultures, languages. Nobody asks you when you're a small person, do you want to do that? You're just thrown and you either sink or swim. I thrived. I enjoyed it. Took me until I was about 15 to realize that not everyone lives that way. I had no idea that some people live in the same house, same country for years.
Have your diverse cultural experiences affected the way that you approach your business and your interventions?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think I think it makes you more risk prone. And I think you're better able to pivot. I think had I had a more stable, for want of a better word, because it's not that it was unstable, but had I lived more of a cookie cutter existence,
plain vanilla,
I don't think it would have suited me as a temperament, a little bit to what we were talking about earlier. I don't think that would have sat well with me as a person. But I think the exposure I had to so much change and so much movement and cultures and languages and religions and all that side of things, I think I can pivot and adapt. And it breeds resilience in the right temperament. So the expat communities worldwide, you see very interesting characters, lots of creativity, lots of resilience, people that are happy to pick up and move, pick up and move and keep adapting. It's a huge skill. And I think a lot of that, of what I bring to the business or the thrill, it's the thrill of the chase and the hunt, the hustle, the entrepreneurship, the risk, all that stuff. You have to be comfortable being uncomfortable.
So in part, that made you an adventurer.
Yeah.
Like a restless spirit, an explorer.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And I'm sort of, sighing at that bit, because the only downside is you're always restless. I don't think. And I've spoken to lots of people who grew up like I did and were called third culture kids and were known as a group that, having been brought up and lived that way, were kind of permanently restless, never at home anywhere, at home everywhere. So we need that turn constantly, that energy.
In addition to resilience, perhaps that helped you become more empathic in the context of recruiting, psychological profiling, and in connecting with people in your business or in your clients' contexts.
Yeah. I think that, because that's something that sets us apart. Recruitment in its essence is a very simple business model. Worldwide, it all kind of works to a similar formula. But our niche, where we're a little bit different, is the profiling. So we don't just send random CVs. We want to know the candidate, what their drivers are, where they think they'll be happiest. Because obviously the happiness factor is what will keep them invested in an employer, which is our potential client, who we also profile. So we spend more time. It's not this human conveyor belt of, oh, well, let me just bounce out CVs and make a fast commission. So it's salesy, but what we do tends to be a little bit deeper. So we've got a lot of fantastic relationships, and having had all that exposure and adaptation that I've had to do in the past, it helps because you are empathic. I can understand where people are coming from. I know why it's such a wrench to change job or how awful it can feel mentally to go to work in a place that you don't feel you belong, or you're not wanted, or you're not thriving, or whatever the thing is. So, yeah, I think that had a big impact.
I want to get back to profiling. Before doing so, What is it that inspired you to set up HR Innovate? What drove you to set up your own business?
Well, I wanted autonomy. It's actually that. It was I needed freedom. I'd reached a not a crisis, but I'd reached a crossroads in my life where I didn't want to be at the whim of an employer. I didn't want to be resentful doing a job and thinking you shouldn't do it that way, or being in an ethical quandary and having to conduct myself according to somebody else's vision. So I thought, well, instead of complaining and being negative, if you think you can do it better, do it. So it was almost like a challenge. Well, okay, you think you're so great, go and do it. So I thought, I'm just going, and I needed the challenge, the risk. I'd kind of reached whatever ceiling there was in Cyprus. Cyprus is small as a job market and a place. And because of my history, I think I was outgrowing it and becoming unfulfilled. So I needed something else if I was going to stay on the island and appreciate what it has to offer. And that was entrepreneurship.
Do you think that perhaps your globe-trotting momentum or pattern of being sort of could not fit in well with a stagnant and permanent workplace framework?
Yeah, I mean, definitely stagnant. Yeah, a permanent workplace, I don't know if there is such a thing anymore. There are no jobs for life. There are no permanent workplaces as such. But we don't have to be stagnant. And that's, I don't think stagnant workplaces hold anyone for very long, not in good condition, without it veering to toxicity or, you know, general unhappiness, which won't do anyone good.
How do you conduct psychological profiling, and how does this practice affect or guide you in the way you conduct your business and in the coaching interventions that you or your colleagues do? Tell us a bit more about psychological profiling, if you may.
I mean, I guess when it comes to the one-to-one in-depth coaching sessions, I do those. I'm the most qualified right now on the team to do them. It's what I studied, what I've done for years in the UK. It has counseling elements. So for that, you need to be experienced, because even though it's careers guidance based, you stumble on mental health issues, and we come across candidates or clients with some very deep mental health issues. So you have a duty of care if you're going to announce yourself as a professional in anything that touches on mental health. So nobody on the team does those sessions apart from me. And in terms of the profiling and psychological aspects of that, everybody's trained on the team. What to look out for, insightful questions, open-ended questions. You're not just phoning someone saying, I've got this great job. Do you want to go for it? Are you available? How much money do you want? You want to find out, because potentially you're impacting someone's life forever. And based on your phone call and the questions you ask and the attention you pay, they may make a decision that affects them, their family, their mental health in future. You know, it's actually the reverberations of what you do as a recruiter are much longer term than most realize. So I think you have a responsibility. So everybody's trained, and we talk a lot as a team about values, ethical, conscious business. Yes, we have to be profitable. Yes, we have cash flow to think about. That's my problem. But that doesn't mean we conduct ourselves in any way that we don't feel comfortable or ethically sound. And we look after the people that we deal with, because they're giving us confidential data. Clients too. I'm talking both sides. Clients entrust you with their recruitment. They're letting you into their business. They're showing you what's going on with their employees, with their workplace, with who's happy, who's not, with their financials. Sometimes you get a lot of access over time, because we try and build long-term relationships. So we tend to get to know our clients really well. So again, you have, you know, I believe, and as a brand, that's kind of one of our mission values, is that we're, you know, we must keep that in mind. So we try not to work with people that don't understand that.
When you conduct psychological profiling, Do you use personality tests?
We don't.
You don't?
No, okay. We don't get into psychometrics. Mm-hmm. There are a lot on the market. No, I wouldn't say we use any metric, mm-hmm. anything data. We did think about it, and we have partners that we can refer to. Some clients use them and will conduct them on their behalf. Mm-hmm. So they'll send us tests and ask us to administer them or send links. No, we don't do anything like that. They're mainly assessment-based, qualitative. So it's finding out when somebody's talking to you, what they mean when they say they're ready to leave a position because they loathe where they are. Mm. What's going on for them? When they say they can't commute because they have childcare issues or family issues, what does that mean to them? So that you can try and broker some sort of happy fit. So we know, because we profile closely, we know the clients where they have tougher sectors or tougher workplaces. So if we have a cat, for example, it might make more sense if I give you a scenario. Sure. So if you look at the tax and audit sector or the fiduciaries, they are very tough environments. They're not for the faint-hearted. They're not for people that are too emotionally fragile for whatever reason or creative. Mm-hmm. They tend to be more closed with a lot of deadlines and pressure. In Cyprus, we have a problem in those sectors, quite a serious one, with toxic environments, managers that don't listen, bullying, occupational harassment, lots of things that we hear all the time. So if I have a candidate that I know is quite depressed or I know is sensitive as a person, before we send them to that other organization for an interview, we will warn them. So we're not going to sell them a glowing, glossy picture. We'll say, it's a great place for a career move. You will learn a lot. Be aware. Mm. There's a lot of pressure. Be aware that this is a sector, this is a company that suffers from these difficult aspects. You have to be resilient. Do you feel like you can be in an environment like that? So we push them to explore how much discomfort they can go through for the right job, if they think it's the right job, and what the driver is. Is it money? Mm-hmm. Is it title? Is it learning? And more we hear, it's happiness.
Is it possible for a person who is sensitive temperamentally and who is more open to adapt and to change so as to be more integrated in such tough workplaces like the law or accounting? So is it possible for someone to be hopeful that by making the leap and entering this new workplace, they can find the means or the courage or the tools to expand their temperamental limits and become a better fit in those harsh environments? Or is it sort of fatal that at some point they will crash or they will burn out?
I think it depends on the employer.
Okay.
If the employer is open and listening, you know, we do, thank God, have employers that, you know, they are listening. They don't want toxicity. They see the benefit of promoting well-being and work-life balance. And they are in those sectors. We have amazing clients that are law firms, tax and audit firms, the traditional harsh environments, that they are investing in their employees' well-being. Now, if I'm listening and I'm investing in your emotional health, you will be more resilient. You will attach to me. You will mutually invest back. But we're building something. We're building a relationship. It's not just a brand and work. We're going to spend over a third of our lives by the time we die at work. So that relationship's going to be significant in building me resilience-wise if I'm sensitive.
I also find that, following what you said, if you are unhappy in the workplace, either because of a personality mismatch or because of a toxic workplace or because the management does not respect or accept you, you are likely to become resentful as an employee. I think resentment is a silent killer, I would say, which reminds me of the boiling frog paradigm, this proverbial story which says that if you boil a pot of water and then when it's on a boiling temperature you throw you drop a frog in, the frog will instantly jump out. But if you place the frog in the lukewarm or cold water, you allow the frog to sit there, and then you gradually raise the temperature. You will bring the water to the same temperature, but because the encroachment of the temperature will be gradual, the frog will become too weak gradually to resist and jump out.
That's so gruesome.
Yeah, so indeed, too weak to escape, yeah. Basically. And some, yeah, I know terrible. That Gallup is doing researches in the workplace, the organization, and they find almost inevitably, with some variation, that approximately, let's say, 15 to 20% of employees are disengaged, not engaged, actively disengaged.
Yeah.
And great part of those are likely to be resentful.
Yes.
So it strikes me that we do not, as employers, let's say, perhaps we are not taking that seriously.
Yeah.
Resentment is a very toxic and poisonous emotion. Or
Well, it's passive aggressive.
Yeah, yeah.
So I can't get out. But while I'm in here, I'm going to sabotage you. So I'll come to work, I'll take my salary, I'll take any benefit you'll give, but then I'll go around town and I'll tell everybody how awful you are. When clients call, I won't be as helpful. I'll be miserable. I'll do whatever I can to turn them away. You know, it's these kind of behaviors that you'll see from employees that are resentful. It's passive aggression, and it will eat the organization from the inside out.
Is it possible when we have these Gallup statistics, and it's like a blueprint, you know that every organization, more or less, will have a certain percentage of people who are resentful or technically, to be more accurate, disengaged.
Yeah.
Is it possible to hope that you can eradicate this problem? What do employers, let's say, have to do to tackle, if this problem can be tackled?
Yeah, it definitely can. But I think apart from changing or doing major interventions to change your internal culture so that you minimize this kind of disengagement, the other thing you can do, and it might be controversial to some, but I always tell my team this, is you coach them out. And we've done this in our company.
Yep.
If I know somebody's not happy and I can see from their performance, their face, their demeanor, that this is not for them, then I'll find them their next best option. So I'm not saying that you go around firing all your employees that look miserable, but I'm saying you can coach them out. You can have good, frank, respectful conversations. I can see you're miserable. I can see you don't want to be here. Where is it you'd like to be?
That's so correct. I think one of the reasons why we do not have such conversations, especially internally, especially in small to mid companies which do not have specific systems and HR infrastructures that can buffer those conversations.
Yeah.
One of the reasons is that if the employer, him or himself, is insecure, and we'll get back to some points on narcissism later, which in part relates to this.
It might be a whole other podcast.
Yes, but okay, so if the employer is unable or unwilling or both to have a conversation which inevitably will reflect on the work environment experience, because the employer may take it personally, like, what do you mean you don't love it here? I mean, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
Because if I don't love it here, you may take it as an insult if you are insecure, or even an attack if you are pathologically driven. So perhaps, at least in some companies in Cyprus, such conversations do not happen because there is no maturity or awareness for the conversations to happen. So to get people to, okay, I will help you out, or I will find you a new job, or at least I will not react in a passive-aggressive manner, treating you as someone who is challenging my ability to run a healthy workplace.
Yeah. But it's like a mutual breakup.
Yes.
Everybody's finally honest that something's fractured. It probably can't be mended. So why don't we part as friends before it gets ugly? because there's no reason for it to get ugly. But there is a degree of emotional intelligence,
yep,
and articulation,
mm-hmm,
and both employer and employee will be well out of their comfort zone when they have that conversation. So most workplaces, they don't want to go there because they don't want to acknowledge that work is emotional. It's not. It's business. It's money. It's cash flow. It's payroll. It's me giving you money to do a job. Most employers have made that mistake. And now there's a shift. And it's a mass psychological conscious shift where everybody's realizing that actually it's not. You can't treat each other that way and take each other for granted that way.
That's a great segue also to the next point I want to ask you about. Okay. The collective psychological shift in the zeitgeist now of the days is, okay, we need to pay attention to workplace happiness, to employees' well-being, and to veer away of the old, you know, the Ford paradigm, the conveyor belt psychology, get people to work like machines. So my question, and it's a bit of a controversial one because it's going to go a bit contrary to conventional wisdom, is this. At what point do we go too far in the direction of promoting employee happiness and paying attention to keeping individuals, employees in the workplace? So one extreme is, you know, get people to work like robots. They are only here for the salary. They get salary. What else do they want? So the old conveyor belt manufacturing business paradigm. The other, is there an opposite pole to this?
Where it's too much?
To this continuum, where it gets too much.
Yes, I mean, we have it. Is it possible to
identify it?
Yeah, I think it is. And it's called tokenism.
Tokenism, okay.
Yeah. So if I'm, they're usually larger organizations who decide that they're going to do a, it's almost like a branding exercise. I'm going to be the best employer in town. I'm going to throw a lot of money at my HR and branding team, and I'm going to throw it around the marketplace. I care about my employees. I'm going to make sure you're all happy if it kills me. So I'm going to give you breakfast. I'm going to give you a lunch allowance. I'm going to give you a manicure at your desk. You can work from home 4 days a week, not just two, four. And they're throwing benefit. It's rubbish because the problem is it's tokenistic. They're not really, they're throwing money at a problem without talking to the employees and without understanding what the shift is. Because we have amazing large companies in Cyprus that still can't retain employees.
They
still
do these things.
Because they do all these things, because the employees know that it has no depth.
It's hollow.
It's hollow. It's reactive. You did this because you know I can leave anytime I want because it's a candidate's market right now. And it has been for a couple of years now, and it's not going to change anytime soon, I don't think. So you know I have you over a barrel, big boss. So that's why you're doing it. You think if you give me a manicure at my desk, I'm not going to leave. So now I'm insulted because you still won't talk to me. You won't engage with me as a human. You won't ask me what I think. You won't really. It's all gone to the extreme. So I think, as with most things in life, you have to have balance. And so, that's where you'll find the best sweet spot.
Could we say that a lot of what we are seeing today is virtue signaling and moral posturing? Like, look at me, I'm the most caring employer. Yeah. I'm the most loving employer there is. So it's like I'm signaling my virtue as an employer of, so it's the employer posturing as a benevolent organization, perhaps.
Yeah. I just think that it's just not honest. And everybody's, I don't know, I think there's been this spin. Everybody's in a spin after the pandemic. And there's a lot of resentment and bitterness in certain sectors. And this is global. I'm not just talking about Cyprus, because we recruit in other countries and we see it. People now, they think there's no job for life. There's no company that when the chips are down, you can definitely be sure we'll stand by you. Because in COVID, tons of people got left on the shelf, fired, whatever. So everybody's out for themselves. There's no loyalty either way. So now when the employers come and they're throwing benefits at people without any weight or authenticity behind it,
mm.
the employees don't feel any guilt. They don't feel any loyalty. They don't think, well, okay, I'll take. And then as soon as somebody offers me more, I'm off. It's transactional.
Mm. And perhaps for the people who are inside, it appears and it's more inauthentic because people tell them, wow, you work for that company. They have these amazing workshops, retreats. And the people inside, if they are not happy as mm-hmm. You suggested, those who are not happy will feel like everyone thinks they are blissful and happy, but they may be miserable.
Yeah.
So it creates a biggest mismatch, perhaps, yeah. between perception and actual experience.
Yeah.
To what extent is an employer responsible for individual employees' happiness as opposed to the individual employee? When we started our talk, you talked about your journey and how you became resilient as a character, as a person,
mm-hmm.
Because of your frequent changes in your life, in countries, in environments, and you grew resilience, okay? And other characteristics as well, I'm sure. Should an employee expect their employer to make them happy? Or is this like a dangerous expectation to have? Or should employees themselves build the character and the resilience and the attributes needed to navigate confidently and in a proper manner in any workplace that they may find themselves in? So whose responsibility is happy? It's a philosophical talk as well.
Yeah, yeah,
happiness is a big term.
It is. It's huge. I think it's like any relationship. First, mm-hmm. you have to acknowledge you're in a relationship.
Yep.
And then it's 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
To go in expecting anyone, employer, husband, wife, anyone to make you happy is only going to lead to disappointment because nobody owes anyone anything. And all relationships, you know, if we're very mercenary about it, even in psychological paradigms, all relationships are transactional. We interact, we have a relationship because we offer something to each other, even if we're unhappy, but we're still in it, we're offering something to each other. And the employer-employee relationship is no different. You have clear expectations. You both signed up for this at the beginning. Naturally, it changes over time. So you have to reevaluate together where you stand each year, each 6 months, whenever the need arises. But no one's responsible. It's no one employee's job to make that employer happy or make the business thrive. Mm-hmm. It's a collective effort. And no employer can guarantee happiness as such. But they have a role to play. And I think they have a duty of care. Because they have a power. It's all, again, about shifts in power and roles. If I pay your wage, I wield a power. We're not equals.
Mm-hmm.
We can't pretend that we're equals when I directly impact your life, your livelihood, your payments, food on your table. So if I acknowledge, if I'm able to acknowledge that I wield that power and that it's a huge responsibility to pay somebody for their services, then that's where you breed respect, because I'm not going to abuse that power. Neither can I guarantee your happiness.
Mm.
It's going to have to be a two-way street.
I get it. So it's 50-50.
Yeah.
Both have to be responsible.
Yeah.
So if the employer, if the employer wields that connection, that salary position as a threat, like I'm paying you, you are indebted to me indefinitely.
Yeah.
So that's pathological.
Yes. And there's lots of it. It's lots and lots of companies are operating like that. And it's to their detriment because now they have massive retention problems because after COVID, people decided they don't care.
Mm.
They don't care. They would rather be out of work. They would rather serve coffee than be an accountant, than be a lawyer, than be an auditor. They're not interested. So it's backfiring on those employers that thought that kind of 1950s approach was going to work. And also, these generations are different. Maybe when I was younger, when I was in my 20s, I would have done anything a manager told me. My generational mindset was I knew I needed to sweep up enough dirt and pay my dues because I didn't know anything. I was a junior. I fully expected mm-hmm. to be mistreated. I was happy to be mistreated. I knew I would make terrible money.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I didn't know anything. And that was fine mm-hmm. because it was transactional. I didn't mind it because I thought, I'm going to learn. I'm up for it. These generations are not like that.
Mm.
And sometimes I'm frustrated and I think they're entitled. You know, they expect everything without working hard enough when they're juniors. And then on the other hand, I think, you know, good for you. Good for you. Why should you accept it?
Mm-hmm.
Why should you sit in your boxed role being mistreated
mm-hmm.
by somebody who wields a bit of power because they pay your wage and tells you you don't know anything? So you'll do what I say. You won't go home at 5 o'clock. You'll go home when I tell you for no extra money. They're not willing to do it. So everything shifts, attitudinal, but it's also psychological. And those employers that don't understand that, they can't keep employees. We have a massive problem globally.
Talking about pathological approaches and expectations, wielding power, there is a lot of talk lately, perhaps due to social media discussions as well, about narcissism.
Mm-hmm.
It's in various domains of conversations. Yeah. Are there narcissists in the Cypriot workplace?
Yeah. I mean, I know a few.
Okay.
but even if I didn't, I would say there has to be.
Mm.
Because narcissism as a trait, as a condition, if you mm-hmm. like, it's not new.
Mm.
It's part of us. You know, there is a dark side to humanity. So yes, there's going to be narcissistic elements in leadership in all kinds of sectors. There always was. We just didn't have the attention that we have now. We didn't have the media. We didn't have the labeling. And that's the only thing I would say. I'm not advocating for narcissists, but we have to be careful of the terms that they bandy around now. You know, they use psychological terms very casually. You know, everybody's autistic at the moment. You know, everybody's a narcissist. Everybody's anything. Do you understand those terms?
Yeah.
You know, can anyone say they haven't appeared narcissistic or had a narcissistic leaning at one point? I don't know. But there is that tendency now, especially in social media, to marginalize and normalize and make mainstream all these very heavy terms. But we do have some interesting characters and some very abusive employers on the market, as they do worldwide. We are not special in Cyprus.
I've listened to a podcast recently which set out that around one out of six people could be a narcissist. It's like, wow, it's huge.
Yeah.
Do people who with a narcissistic propensity tend to populate leadership positions as opposed to other positions? Is it possible to map this trait or propensity onto a specific
I don't think so. I think to generalize like that is dangerous.
Yeah.
And I know that there are some public figures that are behind all this, and it's easy to see why.
Mm.
You know, when you look at the profile of Bezos or Elon Musk, I mean, bless him, Elon Musk. I mean, man, that guy, he's made so many mental health issues mainstream.
Yeah.
Because I mean, he's bizarre. As a person, he's eccentric. He's an innovator.
Mm.
Some people would say he's mad. Most people that work for him never want to see him again. Apparently, he's horrendous to work for.
Mm.
So there is this school of thought that says the more intelligent, the more successful, the more Machiavellian.
Mm.
There's this light and dark meeting that we love.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like fairy tales for children. I don't know that I buy it.
Mm.
I have met amazing people that are mild-mannered.
Mm-hmm.
They're not in the spotlight. They don't need attention. They don't crave it. They have none of those leanings. They just love their product. They love their service. They love their baby, whatever mm-hmm. that baby is. They're just innovators. And they don't seem to have any of those. And they tend to be across lots of different sectors. It does seem that there's more of a concentration of abusive management styles in pressured environments that are more money-centric, mm-hmm. like finance. Okay. We do, as recruiters, hear that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Less of it in tech. In innovative, inclusive environments, there seems to be less of it.
I guess it also has to do with, of course, it's a definitional thing, as you said. We have to be careful with using terms like that. But it's also, if there is a, and I am, if some people identify successful and highly driven individuals with people who have narcissistic tendencies, I guess it could also be a way to denigrate those who are successful, perhaps,
in part. Yeah, there's bound to be a lot of that. And we like to ascribe dramatic personas to people that attract attention because of their successes or because of their risk. You know, there are people that go out there and take huge risks, like Elon Musk, for example. Mm. So they do sort of, they flirt with controversy. They actively invite controversy.
Which borders on the definition on, or some of the definitions of these terms, which is the need to be seen, to be validated. Yeah. But in part, okay, if you say narcissism works on a spectrum with some extremes, in part, we all need to be to feel valued and seen, right, and heard.
Yeah.
So if anyone says that they do not care about whether they are valued, or seen or appreciated, either they have some serious issue of detachment, or they're lying.
Yes. So
we all need to have this to an extent to feel valued.
Yeah.
Now, if that becomes pathologized, as many things do, okay, it's normal, I think. Some people are more on the extreme edge of this need for validation or to engage in controversial topics that will amplify their appeal or their...
Yeah. Yeah,
or their exposure.
It. Yeah.
Or attention seeking.
Hmm? They're seeking it, aren't they? They're, you know, there's so many ways you can avoid it if you want to.
Absolutely.
And there are some that are just transactional. It helps the brand.
Mm-hmm.
The controversy attracts people to their brand. It helps, you know, even what's that old cliche, you know, there's no such thing as bad publicity.
Yeah.
All publicity is good. So if you come from that line of thought and you don't mind people taking shots at you, it works.
What if you are an employee working for a boss, let's say, who is abusive or narcissistic or who is not well behaved? What are your options? Should you leave that job? Should you stay put?
Yeah.
Should you try to change your direct report? Do you have the situations in your business?
Yeah.
You have some sadly. Thoughts. You have some thoughts to share.
We have some really, really sad cases of candidates. And I'm talking junior to partner level. Mm. We have C-suite candidates.
As we victims have, of that behavior.
Yeah. Okay. That are emotionally, mentally, psychologically burnt. They can see the beginnings of physical illness in response to their situation at work. They have all the classic signs of depression. By the time they get to us, they're in bad shape.
Mm.
It's very difficult in us. And if we look at Cyprus only, if I think of the market here, it's so small. Everybody knows everybody. Everybody at some point is related to somebody. Mm. You can't go very far without knowing someone. So they also have this intense scrutiny and feeling like if I show or tell people I'm being bullied or I'm burnt, I won't be able to get a job anywhere else. Mm. Or they're going to make sure I don't. Or, you know, they have all this stress because it's so small here.
Mm.
So by the time they pluck up the courage to confide in us, they're in pretty bad shape. And they have all the signs of depression. You know, they have uncontrollable bouts of crying, unexplained emotional intensity, mood swings, sleep issues, eating issues, mood disturbance, bouts of anger, frustration, resentment. I mean, the list goes on of the symptoms of their misery that they can directly trace to what's happened or is still happening at work. And these are, like I said, it's not just juniors. Mm. Actually, it's less. Tends to be mid-level and up.
High pressure situation.
Yeah, and they feel trapped, either because their abuser They don't think they can get away. They're trapped by the money. They've got loans. They've got kids. Mm. They feel societal pressure because they maybe don't want to be in that profession anymore. They're so burnt out. Mm. But family and friends are saying, what, you don't want to be a lawyer anymore? Doesn't everybody want to be a lawyer? You know, all this kind of intense judgment. Mm. So they come, they're crying, they're telling us horrendous stories. And it's really difficult because if somebody comes to you and they're that broken down, you can have a tremendous impact on what you say, but it's not for you to decide for them. So what we try to do is empower them to make their own choice, but to make a healthy choice. So I can't say to somebody, God, quit, you know, for God's sake, that's ridiculous, because I don't know what their financial commitments are. I don't know if they'll cope. So what we try and do, it's very counseling like, you know, but we try and make them understand that if you have an issue at work that is now affecting your psychological well-being, your ability to interact in life at home with your family, everything to do with your physical being is now at risk, because you can only go so long with those symptoms without manifesting some sort of physical illness. Then you have a choice to make, and you have to decide whether you are going to put up with that or whether you're just going to leave for the sake of your health. Because funnily enough, it seems a lot of people don't think health is enough of a reason to leave. They almost feel like it's a weakness. So we try and make them understand that you can make that choice. There's nothing to be ashamed of by saying, you know what, I'm out. You're literally making me ill. So now money's not enough. Title's not enough. Your brand, your prestige is not enough. I'm out. So we have candidates, for example, that are partner level, big four, big six, big eight. Just leave. Give it all up. Title, money, the works. To figure out what they want to do in life, but without that abuse, toxicity.
Do you have any war story, no name, of course, to share, which particularly took your attention, like on such a level, a big level?
Yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, I did. I again, prestigious brand, big four. So international. Prestigious, amazing clients, beautiful offices. They even have a well-being program. How funny is that? How sick is that? I have a well-being program. Imagine I'm selling it to clients. So I have consultants and advisors who will sell for a lot of money a well-being program. I'm out there in public doing this. I'm saying, I'm an employer that believes in this. I'm going to promote happiness. I've got a happiness officer. I've got a happiness. God knows what the label is everywhere. But inside, I have allowed sexual harassment. I've allowed bullying. I've allowed massive incidences of mental health issues, glaringly obvious to everybody in the workplace. And when people have been whistleblowers or they've reported it, I've told them, shut up and go home. If you don't like it, off you go. But I'm not going to fry my managers, my partners. I'll protect the club at the top. I'm going to ignore everybody else. That we've seen. And those are our big four. I mean, those are the big brands.
When you have those conversations, I guess two cups come in mind. So the cup of the psychologist, the cup of the coach.
Yeah.
Is it correct that the psychologist primarily focuses on the past to identify traumas and the coach on the future, or that's a cliche? Like the coach empowers for the sets goals. No, the client sets goals and the coach empowers, whereas the psychologist tries to decipher and to shed light on the past, or that's a myth?
No, it's not a myth. It's partially true, depending what kind of therapist you are. So if you go for psychoanalysis, for example, you should expect, or you should be ready to unpack issues from the past. Psychologists that are cognitive behavioral therapists, for example, or any type of coach, and I say that word like that because coach as well has been messed about and repackaged in social media so many times that I think it lacks a lot of respect. But they should be looking at empowerment. And we do have what we call client-centered approaches. Mm. So you have psychologists that are client-centered. So you will lead what you get out of the time we share together. It's not for me. But at the same time, a psychologist has the qualifications and has the direction in their sessions to be assessing. As a coach, you're not assessing mental health. You shouldn't be. You don't. That a coach doesn't have that.
You don't touch that.
No, you shouldn't. You may touch on it superficially, and you may refer them if you suspect that they have deeper issues. You may say to them, "Why don't you maybe see about getting some psychological help?" But that's not for a coach. Coaches are goal oriented. They'll stick to areas that are not as deep or as complex as mental health illness, that kind of spectrum. But the psychologist is always assessing, and they're always paying attention to symptoms, words, signposting, but not like a psychiatrist. You won't necessarily go back in time. It's up to the client, and you're not prescribing. You're not labeling as such.
A typical Freudian approach. Your relationship with your father, your mother.
Yeah, and there's a place for it.
Of course.
You know, it's and psychiatrists too. I mean, I can be very brutal about psychiatrists because the medicating is always, you know, controversial. But there is a place for them. And there are mental health illnesses where you do need medication.
I totally agree. Yeah.
And that's that. There's a place for it.
There's a point where talking will simply not do.
No.
So some interventions have to be drastic, and there, that might be inevitable.
Yeah.
So a psychiatric intervention might be inevitable.
And professionals have to be able to recognize the difference when something is biochemical, hormonal. There could be other issues that need medication to regulate them before the person can address the mental health issues.
It's the invisible hemorrhage, which is a stigma as well. When you see someone who has a broken leg with a plaster, oh, poor you.
Yeah.
When somebody is depressed, what's wrong with you? You look fine.
Yeah.
You have a great job. So it's a stigma there.
Yeah, and that happens a lot. And the reason we see it a lot in C-suites is because if you're a C-suite, especially if you're a male C-suite, I mean, in this culture, if we look at Cyprus again, actually, that's not fair, not just in Cyprus. I'm thinking even in the US, where men will be men.
Yeah.
And there's this machismo. And, you know, you're the big dude, right?
Mm.
You're a C-suite, top of your game. Your parents struggled and paid for the best education. You know, we've all heard the story. Mm. They're a huge success.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you miserable about? You've got kids. You settled down. You're not old. You're not young.
Mm.
And you're a leader at work. And you have this brand that you represent or you've created. So there's so much assumption and judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't want to hear that somebody's breaking down. Like the candidate I'm thinking of that keeps coming to my mind. I mean, she was director level in a big four.
Mm.
They didn't care that she was burnt, that she was quite obviously emotionally distressed because she was working 15 hours a day, 6-7 days a week. But the response was, well, you're top of your game.
Mm.
Isn't that what people do when they reach that level? What did you expect?
It's also a confusion between, you know, success may look like a badge of honor and a badge of happiness, but it can also mean a desperate, everlasting need for validation.
Yeah.
So some people are very successful, at least in part, in my view, as part of their desperate need to continually seek validation.
Yeah.
In part.
Yeah.
So when somebody is very successful, this does not necessarily mean that they no longer have an itch to scratch. So validation is an itch that sometimes will always need scratching and tending and caring.
Yeah.
So if the person is not balanced and they continue to do what they know best, getting certificates, bonuses, that doesn't mean that that person does not need some intervention or
help. It doesn't mean they're satisfied.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean it's the end.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't mean that their happiness is infinite.
Mm.
And it doesn't mean they can't struggle. But there are a lot of judgments like that made, especially on C-suites and what success looks like. But that's where the well-being part comes in. If you invest in the well-being of your organization, mm-hmm. you know, your cash flow and your finances, but also your people, that should extend to everyone.
The invisible wound. Yeah, yeah. Mental health. It's yeah. so important.
Yeah, it's massive. And the thing is, to the unfeeling employer, I say to them, well, okay, so if you're only going to care about costs and productivity, riddle me this. If your employee is not happy, is depressed, is not sleeping, eating, crying, you can tell me they're that productive. Are they delivering the best service? Are they working to maximum efficiency? No, you're going to suffer anyway. Your numbers will suffer.
Is the elephant trunk under the carpet? You see it. Most employers see, if they are not self-blinded, that some of the people around them are beginning to feel depressed or they are not well. And the point is that unless they are brave and confident enough to spend the time and energy and resources needed to tackle the problem,
yeah.
you know, the elephant will come out of the rug and swallow them.
It's going to happen.
People will leave or people will
explode. Happened.
It's happening.
Because that's what happened after COVID.
Yeah, yeah.
Before COVID, a lot of these types of employers said, well, it's okay. They don't like it. Off they go. I've got 10 that will take their place.
And that's a post-hoc rationalization as well.
Unbelievable. Yes. I mean, it's outrageous. So it's like a human conveyor belt, but I don't care. After COVID, I did. After COVID, with this huge shift, we have clients that are telling us they can't serve clients. They have to stop projects because they can't get staff.
Yep.
Every 5 minutes, they're losing staff. Now, the best ones are upset. The ones that don't care continue, but now they have retention problems.
What are the greatest challenges that HR innovate and such and companies in this industry face? What's the greatest challenge? Is it generating business? Is it branding? Is it competing? Have you managed to pinpoint what's the like the top challenge that your suite faces?
Well, I think if I think of the team, because I'm seeing all their faces now.
Is it keeping your people, for example? Is it?
No, actually it's not. I mean, it isn't easy to do recruitment. So we do lose people, like, you know, all employers. They come, they think it's easier than it is. You know, it's a tough gig. But I think the biggest challenge that you face in this sector is getting them to listen. Clients. Because you're saying to them, all we do day and night as recruiters is talk. We listen and we talk to candidates and companies all over the world, not just Cyprus. So when I'm giving you feedback, because the other thing we do that's a little bit different is we tell the client what we've heard about them to help. And we tell them, this might be difficult for you to hear, but we can't source for you because you have such a bad reputation. Until you do something about your employer branding, or this manager, for example, that we have told you everybody is saying is a bully, is this, is that, we can't recruit for you. Now, we can make suggestions, how we can help and give you advice and suggestions and tell you what's going on without revealing candidate names. But they don't listen. The majority of clients, yeah, I'd say it's probably 60-40. 60% not listening. They're not listening. Now, in fairness to a lot of them, they're not listening because they'll say, well, you know, life and business is hard enough with all the wars going on and the sort of geopolitical climate now and worldwide, everything's a blah, blah, blah. I don't have time. I can't be worrying so much about my HR. I need to make sure we're around next year. You know, some of them are like that. And then a lot of them just don't care. They're not interested. We're telling them and they're not interested. So that makes it really difficult as a recruiter, if you're trying to do a good job, if you're honest, because we won't pitch an employer that we know is not sound.
At what point should an employer consider hiring an internal HR? Is this always fashionable discussion? Is it over 60 people? Is it over 80 people? Over 100 people? Is it like a yardstick that, especially for Cyprus, can be followed?
Yeah, I mean, I think once you head plus 25, I think 25 employees.
Really?
Somewhere there, you should get internal HR.
Like full time?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yes, if you're going to invest.
Yeah.
Because again, when you make that gesture, when you make that statement by bringing an internal HR, you're saying, we have a human resources function. Mm. It starts with so-and-so as an officer. We're going to put in protocols, processes. We're going to have policy. We're going to listen to you. Benefits, programs. You'll have someone to talk to. We will have someone to communicate through.
So it's an actual investment and a message as well. We're paying somebody full time for this.
It's huge.
It's not just the brochures.
No.
Yeah.
I'm not just hiring an admin. Mm. I'm not hiring somebody who's going to come and just fire people, because this is the other thing we've seen in Cyprus a lot. They hire HR and the HR is a receptionist.
Mm.
It's usually a female. And it's somebody who does four different things. They're admin, they're a PA, they're a receptionist, they may be a messenger sometimes.
Payroll manager, managing the payroll.
It's bizarre, but they're not used for the HR function. That's kind of the least of it. And then, you know, that kind of gesture will backfire, because nobody takes HR seriously then.
Yep.
It's just disrespected. So when you do it the right way, you're showing the employees that you're investing in them.
Mm.
And it shows that you're... trendy is the wrong word, but it shows that you're a conscious employer and you've understood that you've reached a certain size where you need another layer for the employees. But you have to let the HR do their job. And this is what we see often doesn't happen. We even see a lot, not so much now, but they used to hire HR to do all the firing, all the uncomfortable things.
Like, to have the uncomfortable conversations.
So what happens then? You do this gesture, you're saying, I'm investing in HR. Isn't this great? I'm such a great employer. Every time you see the HR, they're firing someone. So as the employee, you're thinking, whoa, okay. So HR is this big, bad, malevolent representative of the bosses who don't have the balls, forgive my French.
Yes, exactly. You read my mind.
To do their own dirty work.
That's a bad message to give.
Yeah. So HR, again, is misconstrued and not used properly. And we see this a lot in Cyprus, in local companies. Which is a bit of a shame, but it's changing.
It's like a trendy name for the boss's bodyguard.
Yeah.
Like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a really tough job.
Or a buffer, but in a negative sense, like a buffer, like I'll send my buffer to sort this out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Fantastic.
Yeah. It can be a really amazing tool. And when you're thinking of happiness and well-being and the investment side of it, your HR is your ambassador.
Mm.
It's a no-brainer. I mean, in my head, I don't see that. You know, I've had employees that I knew weren't happy there. Why do I want them there miserable by force? Why wouldn't I?
Well, people have a dark side as well, you know?
Yeah, I guess. Well, yeah, if they're bullies, then they actively enjoy
it. They derive pleasure out of making people
submissive
or slaves.
Yeah. And the other thing I think is sad is some of them are so successful.
Mm.
I think they took advantage of a boom years ago.
Yep.
They got big fast.
Mm.
They made a lot of money cutting corners.
Mm-hmm.
So morals and everything sort of took a downturn. And I think they got so greedy that it is a form of narcissism, in the sense that they lost all sense of proportion.
Mm.
And they think they're invincible. You don't want a job here? I don't care. Off you go. And of course, even those guys now can't recruit.
It's incredible, huh? The way you build a business, if it's built on an eroded foundation by cutting corners, and you as the builder, as the founder, inevitably will also grow into a person who is lacking the necessary integrity to place the business on the right track, because everything is built incorrectly and on the basis of a rotten foundation.
Yeah.
So you become rotten as well as the founder.
And you're not going to be happy, ultimately.
Corrupted, I would say, not rotten.
Yeah.
The whole thing is corrupted.
The way it grows. Yeah, and it's like a rot.
Yeah, yeah.
From the inside out.
So the whole thing is corrupted.
It makes no sense, because you don't help anyone then. Not the business to thrive, not the employees, not you as the founder. You're not going home satisfied. Not your community, not your business community, no one. It's pointless.
Being mindful of the time, your time and the studio's time, I will have to ask you the last questions.
Uh-oh. Go on.
So, Katerina, can you share the worst piece of advice you ever received?
Oh, the worst piece of advice. Work work. What was the worst piece of advice? I think the worst piece of advice was look the other way.
Mm.
You're an employee.
Mm.
It's not your place, not your business. Look the other way. That was probably the worst advice because it had the worst impact. Because what it did was it just sucked the air out of the room.
Mm.
And it was a bullying tactic that was meant to remind me that I had no power, no say, no input, and that somebody with more power could just do what they liked.
So look the other way. It's like...
Put your head down and just work.
Yeah, do what you're supposed to do.
Yep, not your problem.
Mm.
Don't care. Keep doing it.
And what is the best piece of advice you ever received? That's the final question.
The best piece of advice. I've had some amazing managers. I was very lucky when I was young. And one of them, he was a really tough taskmaster. But he said, wherever possible, be humble.
Mm.
That was the best advice I ever got. He said, don't ever take any win,
mm-hmm.
any success for granted. Higher you climb, further you fall. And never think you're special. Mm. It's always going to be an individual ride. Your ride is not somebody else's. So be humble.
They say that the first step in becoming a master in a new domain is the fool. You have to be a fool, admit that you are not there yet.
Yes.
So it also reflects on the humble, being humble, I think. Admitting that you don't know everything.
Don't. And nobody ever does.
As the first step towards knowing something, perhaps.
That's why I always tell the team, if you don't know something, never pretend you do. There's no need. Not for anybody. You just tell the candidate, tell the client, I don't know. It is not, life ending. We'll figure it out.
Katerina, thank you so much. We could have been discussing for a couple
for
of
days.
More hours for sure, for coming to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you.
Continue the great work.
Thank you, likewise.
And the best, all the best for your business and your team.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Is this another game of my mind? I'm wide awake. I hear my name. I turn around, there's no one again. I won't forget the day she left. Slam the door and never